Hello, ahlan wa sahlan, and welcome to another episode of Arab Voices, coming to you from the studios of KPFT Houston since 2002. Houston's community station, 90.1 FM and FM HD1. This is Saeed, executive producer and host of Arab Voices. This show is syndicated and it airs on other radio stations in different cities in the US and Europe. It has been over 2 months now since Israel launched its genocidal war on the Palestinians, causing a catastrophic situation for 2.3 million Palestinians living in the Gaza Strip. Israel's ongoing bombardment from the air, sea, and land has killed more than 16,000 Palestinians, 70% of whom are children and women. Thousands of Palestinians remain under the rubble of countless residential buildings bombed and destroyed by apartheid Israel. 1.8 million out of the 2.3 million in the Gaza Strip were forced out of their homes as part of apartheid Israel's ethnic cleansing of Palestine. And it is not just in the Gaza Strip, but it also includes the occupied West Bank, where Israel and its colonizers have killed 260 Palestinians there since October 7th, injured hundreds more, and has been kidnapping Palestinians on a daily basis from various cities in the occupied West Bank. The health situation in the Gaza Strip is so horrific, with most hospitals in the Gaza Strip being out of service due to Israeli bombing and lack of fuel and medical supplies to operate these hospitals. At least 250 doctors and medical aid workers have been killed, and 59 ambulances were targeted and destroyed by apartheid Israel. According to the health ministry, more than 117,000 cases were reported of acute respiratory infection, more than 86,000 cases of diarrhea and severe dehydration in children under the age of 5, and more than 50,000 cases of skin diseases. According to the World Health Organization, since October 7th, the organization documented 212 attacks on healthcare in the Gaza Strip that resulted in at least 565 fatalities, 732 injuries, affecting 56 health facilities and 59 ambulances. Since the temporary ceasefire ended, Israel has intensified its offensive across all areas of the Gaza Strip, bombarding homes, killing hundreds of people, and injuring thousands more. Even Gaza's Palace of Justice compound, which housed the Palestinian Supreme Court, the Court of Appeal, the Court of First Instance, and the Magistrate, was destroyed. Israeli occupation soldiers inside the Gaza Strip videotaped themselves detonating the building and laughing after that. Hundreds of thousands of vital case documents have been destroyed, another war crime deliberately targeting civilian infrastructure. 2.3 million Palestinians, half of them children, are now living in constant mortal terror. On December 4th, the World Health Organization received notification from the Israeli army asking the organization to remove supplies from its medical warehouse in southern Gaza within 24 hours. Can you imagine that? Let me repeat it. The World Health Organization received notification from the Israeli army asking the organization to remove supplies from its medical warehouse in southern Gaza within 24 hours. Medical Aid for Palestinians has reported that Israel's indiscriminate bombardment and siege is making it impossible to sustain human life in Gaza. Israel's actions are supported and financed by the U.S. government with U.S. taxpayers' money, Britain and other Western governments that have been providing Israel with full impunity for its war crimes and genocide against the Palestinians. This is Dr. Mads Gilbert, a Norwegian physician specializing in emergency medicine who has helped provide emergency trauma care in Gaza for over 40 years, with a message to Western leaders.
President Biden, Mr. Blinken, are you awake? EU President Dr. Ursula von der Leyen, President Macron, can you hear the screams from Gaza yesterday? Can you hear the screams as the Israeli war machine bombed yet another UN school and shelter? Can you hear the screams from the thousands injured? Yesterday, the Israeli war machine killed another 700 Palestinian civilians in Gaza. 70% being women and children. Can you hear them? Yes, you hear them. And you do nothing. You do less than nothing. You actively support the Israeli war machine in their killing and maiming of civilians day by day. And guess what? So far, they have killed 15,500 Palestinians in Gaza and hundreds in the West Bank. And in Gaza, 70% of the killed are women and children, innocent Palestinians. And you not only let it happen, you support it with your weapons, with your political support, and your lack of action with sanctions and other political instruments to stop and contain the Israeli killing of Palestinians. So far, more than 41,000 Palestinians are injured, and they have destroyed the whole healthcare system. And you let it happen on your call. And Dr. Ursula von Leyen, didn't you swear an oath when you became a doctor to protect life? Are you having any moral? Do you not feel guilty for this systematic killing? The industrial scale of killing in Gaza reminds many of us of the industrial, horrible scale of killing of Jews by the Nazi German army in 1940-45. Why should this happen again? And why should it happen to the Palestinian people? Because you want it to happen. This is not self-defense for Israel. This is an all-out genocide of the Palestinian people in Gaza and the West Bank. This is the politics of elimination, systematic killing with industrial-scale military attacks on an unprotected Palestinian civilian population. You are responsible. You are writing your names in the darkest, blackest pages of the history books. You are complicit, and you will be accountable. Stop the killing of Palestinians. Lift the siege. Immediate ceasefire. Protect the hospitals and the healthcare workers. Get water, food, medical supplies, and fuel to the people of Gaza immediately. It's happening on your call. You are the responsible. Stop Israel mass murder and genocide in Gaza.
Absolutely horrific situation in the Gaza Strip. Apartheid Israel published a map which splits the Gaza Strip into 2,376 numbered zones, supposedly to tell Palestinians, move from zone 1 to zone 2, move from zone 50 to zone 51. This is nothing but a PR for Western media and politicians and has nothing to do with the reality on the ground, as Israel has been bombing every area in the Gaza Strip with no zone restrictions whatsoever. And who is kidding who? The 2.3 million Palestinians in Gaza have no clue about this zoning map that Israel just created. They do not have electricity or internet to watch news or know what zone they are in anyway. They don't even have means to get the message to move from one area to another. Again, it is just a PR for Western politicians and media to make it easier for them to justify their support for the slaughter of Palestinians. When Texas politicians told a news media outlet that Israel is the most honorable army in the world for telling people to move from one area to another before bombing it. What a shame. This zoning map has not provided any sense of security for civilians, but actually heightens the panic amongst Palestinians who are desperately seeking a scrap of land where they can find shelter, food, and safety. This map does not represent a serious attempt by Israel to protect civilian life, but rather a new tactic by which the occupied population are terrorized. This is Noor Harazin, a Palestinian journalist inside Gaza.
Let me explain to you what is happening in Gaza now. Over the past weeks, Palestinians in the north have been fleeing their homes for safety in the safe southern Gaza. Now, and over the past 2 days, 3 days, since the humanitarian truce expired, the Israeli forces are intensively attacking the safe southern Gaza. Specifically, the city of Khan Yunis, and Khan Yunis is the second Palestinian city in the coastal enclave in the Gaza Strip. We're talking about hundreds of thousands of people that are living there, maybe a million. And not only the residents, but also people who fled their homes.
It appears that apartheid Israel has bigger plans for the Gaza Strip, and what we are about to witness over the next few weeks is more massive killing of Palestinians, more destruction of every inch above ground in the Gaza Strip, and most likely force 2.3 million Palestinians, or whoever is left alive, out of the Gaza Strip into Egypt. An ongoing Nakba for the Palestinians that started over 75 years ago and continues to this date. Many are even warning that this could also happen to Palestinians in the West Bank. But as history has shown us, the Palestinian people, despite all of this, remain resilient and steadfast against all atrocities and ethnic cleansing plans they are subjected to. This is Palestinian-Canadian Hala Shaer sharing a message to everyone who advocates for ethnic cleansing and believes evacuating and removing Palestinians from their homeland is the answer.
In the face of countless calls for Palestinians to seek refuge in other countries like Jordan and Egypt, I want to convey this message to those who advocate for our ethnic cleansing. We possess a strong spirit, a spirit forged through 75 years of enduring oppression. We stand firm, resolute, and unyielding. Palestine is not only our land, it is the very essence of our identity. We shall not be uprooted from our ancestral lands, nor shall our determination waver. Our roots run deep, and our love for this land is unshakable. We remain steadfast in our yearning for liberation, unwavering in our resolve to stand our ground. Our spirit burns with the unquenchable flame, a flame that shall not be extinguished by those who seek to erase our presence. With every sunrise, we renew our commitment to Palestine, our cherished homeland. There should never be calls for relocation. Rather, the solution is simple. The calls should be for the end of the occupation.
On December 6th, and in a rare move, the United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres invoked Article 99 of the United Nations Charter, urging the United Nations Security Council to act on the war in Gaza, help avert a humanitarian catastrophe, and declare a ceasefire, because the United Nations has failed to do so since October 7th. This is Stéphane Dujarric, spokesperson for the United Nations Secretary General.
Given the scale of the loss of human life in Gaza and in Israel in such a short amount of time, the Secretary General has today delivered a letter to the President of the Security Council invoking Article 99 of the Charter of the United Nations. This is the first time that Antonio Guterres has done this since he became Secretary General in 2017. Article 99 states, and I quote, that the Secretary General may bring to the attention of the Security Council any matter in his opinion that may threaten the maintenance of international peace and security. In the letter, which has been shared with you, the Secretary General urges the members of the Security Council to press to avert a humanitarian catastrophe, and he appeals for a humanitarian ceasefire to be declared.
Will anything come out of the declaration of Article 99, even if the United Nations Security Council acts on it? I don't think so. Nothing will materialize on the ground to force apartheid Israel to stop its genocide against the Palestinians. Maybe after Israel finishes destroying the Gaza Strip and force millions out of it, they will stop. I don't understand how the United Nations Secretary General is invoking Article 99 now, 2 months into this catastrophe, saying to help avert a humanitarian catastrophe. My goodness, humanitarian catastrophe was already declared by the entire world 2 months ago from day one, and it has gotten worse every single second of the past 2 months. And we are still talking about, let's try to avert a humanitarian catastrophe? It's already there. There is, despite all of that, a worldwide support for the Palestinians by people from various nations calling for ceasefire and a permanent end to apartheid Israel's atrocities, genocide, and war crimes against the Palestinians. In previous episodes of Arab Voices, I aired some of the remarks delivered at the Emergency Palestine Teach-In held in October 2023 at the University of Houston, organized by the Arab American Educational Foundation Center for Arab Studies. I'm going to air today the remaining remarks delivered at that event. Let's listen now to the remarks of Professor Adela Cedillo, Assistant Professor of Mexican History at the University of Houston. The voice you will hear first is that of Dr. Abdelrazzaq Takriti, Associate Professor and Arab American Educational Foundation Chair in Modern Arab History and Founding Director of the Arab American Educational Foundation Center for Arab Studies at the University of Houston.
I am very honored to be introducing Professor Adela Cedillo, who is courageous, who knows a lot about settler colonialism, as somebody with an incredible indigenous Mexican heritage, who's a fantastic scholar of Mexico and an assistant professor of Mexican history here at the University of Houston. She's very popular with her students. She's very popular with her colleagues. We love her. Please give her a big applause.
Well, thank you to the Arab Center for the invitation. So after such powerful interventions, I feel intimidated because my notes are related to the history of the solidarity movement with Palestine in Latin America and the responses by multiple actors from the region to the current situation. So it's less emotional and more formal. I will start. So the Cuban Revolution marked a watershed in the way that the Latin American left responded to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Before that, the socialist left lacked a unified position, as some groups had connections with the socialist Zionists from Israel. However, in 1966, Cuba promoted the Tricontinental Conference, which focused on anti-colonial and anti-imperialist struggles in the Global South. The conference founded the Organization of Solidarity with the People of Asia, Africa, and Latin America. From that moment on, there was a growing consensus among the Latin American left to support the Palestinian anti-colonial struggle. And there's no doubt for the left that this was a case of colonialism and nothing else. So in present day, even though Cuba is not as active in the promotion of tricontinental solidarity as in the past, even though the Latin American socialist left is divided in multiple currents and groups, one of the very few causes in which there is still a consensus is the support to the Palestinian cause. So this unifies everyone in the left in Latin America. So there are committees of solidarity with Palestine in most Latin American countries, and some of them are significant in numbers. That is the case of Chile, which concentrates the largest diaspora of Palestinian refugees outside the Arab world. So in the current context, Latin America has several several presidents that come from these socialist movements from the past. So the leftist governments of Cuba, Venezuela, Colombia, Nicaragua, and Bolivia have publicly declared their support to Palestine. Nevertheless, other center-left governments in the region have had different reactions. The president of El Salvador, Nayib Bukele, which is from Palestinian descent. He sent a message focused on the condemnation of Hamas and the distinction of the Palestinian cause from Hamas actions. I will explain that later. So in Brazil, which has the largest Jewish population in Latin America, the government of Luiz Inácio da Silva express a position based on the respect of the human rights of the civil population from both the Palestinian and the Israeli sides, a position that was not welcomed by the Israeli government. As moderate as it is, it was rejected. The case of Argentina is very peculiar. The country has the second largest Jewish population in Latin America, but it used to have a strong tradition of anti-Semitism, which included the elimination of the leftist Jews during the past military dictatorship. Therefore, regardless of their political affiliations, the Argentinian governments in democracy have tended to take the Israeli side. This position, based on their guilt for past crimes, is similar to what we observe in the case of Germany. So, like the ones who are paying for the crimes that were committed domestically are the Palestinians, which is like, makes no sense. In the case of Chile and Mexico, both their presidents and their foreign ministers sent contradictory messages. While condemning Hamas, the Minister of Foreign Affairs in Chile also condemned the use of violence against civil population, which he deemed unacceptable even in the context of self-defense, which is like a normal moral stance. However, after the ambassador of Israel in Chile criticized the minister's position, the president, Gabriel Boric, expressed his solidarity with the Israeli people. In Mexico, it was the other way around. The Minister of Foreign Affairs condemned the Hamas attacks, but the president, Andrés Manuel López Obrador, delivered a different message. He criticized the attacks on civil population by both sides and rejected a violent solution to the conflict. The Israeli ambassador in Mexico then manifested their inconformity against López Obrador's position. He sent a letter to the Mexican government stating that they expected a firmer response to support Israel. Otherwise, the president's neutrality would be perceived as a defense of terrorism. As we can see, the Israel government has condemned any discourse calling to the defense of the human rights of the civil population on both sides. The position of the Mexican president is based on his affiliation to the ideology of revolutionary nationalism. The Mexican governments who embrace this current in the 20th century defended the right of all nations to have a sovereign government and the principle of non-intervention in the affairs of foreign nations. Resulting from the fact that Mexico has gone through 3 centuries of colonization, several foreign invasions, and massive territorial dispossession. There's no other country in this world, and correct me if I'm wrong, that has been stolen so much land as the Mexican people. So there's a double standard, because while the US government accepts the claim by the Israeli government or the Israeli people that they have the right to the historical land, to the land where they once lived, this is not the case for the Mexican people. Can you imagine if Mexican people made this claim that, give us back all the land that you took from us, a land that was taken in a very extremely violent way. So Mexicans, we cannot forget what happened during the Mexican-American War. We cannot forget how the country was taken, invaded, but how women were raped, even nuns, by the American troops. Prisoners were scalped. There was even a battalion formed by Irish people who couldn't stand the atrocities and against the Mexican population, and especially the desecration of the Catholic religion, the temples, and the raping of nuns. So it's called the St. Patrick Battalion. And most of the members of this battalion were also executed by the American troops. We cannot forget this violence. We cannot forget it because, well, not only because we are reminded every day that half of the American territory, Texas, California, Arizona, New Mexico, Nevada, parts of Utah and Wyoming were once Mexico and also were indigenous land. But we cannot forget because every day our people get killed at the border. Our children are in cages, are put in cages. Every Mexicans like are shot at the border by vigilante groups and nobody cares. So we are, of course, we strongly feel, many of us, I'm not speaking on behalf of all Mexicans, of course, but many of us, we understand the ordeals of the Palestinian people. We feel this deep solidarity from colonized subject to colonized subject. We know how it feels when your land is stolen and you are treated as a foreigner in the land of your ancestors. So we stand with Palestine. Viva Palestina Libre.
That was Professor Adela Cedillo, Assistant Professor of Mexican History at the University of Houston, speaking at the Emergency Palestine Teach-In held in October 2023 at the University of Houston, organized by the Arab American Educational Foundation Center for Arab Studies. You're listening to Arab Voices, originating on KPFT Houston since 2002 and syndicated on other radio stations in different cities in the U.S. and Europe. This is Saeed, executive producer and host of Arab Voices. I'm going to air next the remarks of Professor Hossam Abul-Ila, Arab American Educational Foundation, Ajuz Chair in Arab Studies at the University of Houston, speaking at the Palestine teaching event we just talked about, introduced by Dr. Abdel Razak Takriti.
Now we have from Egypt, Professor Hossam Abul-Ila. Egypt is playing a very key role in the process that is unfolding in Gaza today. Their ethnic cleansing plan at the moment is directed towards Egypt. The idea is to remove large parts, if not the entirety of the Gazan population, to Sinai. This is not a new plan. It's been made since the Nakba in different forms. It was actually started as an American plan, and now you have American officials pushing for it. But we know that the people of Egypt have resisted it before, as have the people of Palestine. And I'm very honored to be introducing Professor Hossam Abul-Ila, who is Ajuz Burhan and Misako Ajuz Chair of Arab Studies here at the University of Houston.
So start off, condolences to those of you who've lost family in the current violence. I'm going to follow up on the lead of my colleagues and focus a little bit on children. It makes sense that when we're observing wars of brutality that we focus on the innocents. And no one embodies innocence more than children and babies. And this is also, like, I think, the focus of some of the American news coverage of the events of last Saturday. So for that reason, these media reports of last weekend's surprise attack focused on Israeli children to depict the attack as targeting civilians. Of course, nothing can excuse targeting of innocents. When they die horrifically, we are horrified. Now, in the history part of this teach-in, we've seen some of the context of the siege of Gaza, of the Gaza Strip, and some of you know that history already, that in 2005, Israeli settlements were dismantled, Israelis effectively left the Strip. A few years later, they sealed it off, and they made it difficult to get in basic supplies. And we've seen, interestingly, there was talk in 2005 about the pullback of the Israelis being some sort of like stepping back from colonial occupation. And what we've seen is that something much, much worse, like there's a sort of carte blanche now in the Gaza Strip that you didn't, and has been since the pullout, a kind of carte blanche that you don't have when you have settlers living next to the colonized. So this is the history of the siege of the Gaza Strip was a few years after the pullout. Then the Israelis took control of the border and they made it very difficult to get in basic supplies. And ever since then, there's been a shortages of electricity, of water, of basic foodstuffs. Ingenious Gazans have manufactured their own way to get fuel to fuel their automobiles. And it's been a kind of like creation of a new type of contemporary life that one doesn't see in settings other than this very unique one. So this is the context. So about 2 million citizens, the majority of them are either refugees or direct descendants of refugees. There's been a kind of slow motion catastrophe in the Strip, and it's been playing out now that the embargo itself has been in place for over 15 years. So the water and electricity in short supply has had specific results. And the result has been a siege on the basic health of the citizenry of the Strip. Okay, so I'm here to talk about children. Let's talk about children. So consider the innocent children of Gaza. In 2017, a British medical journal, The Lancet, found an alarming rate of stunted growth among its children. This is the result of years without access to potable water. because the embargo and multiple bombing campaigns have destroyed the water infrastructure, Gazans have depended for years on desalinated water in plastic bottles. Now, this water may be up to 70% contaminated with fecal matter, according to one study. The high nitrate levels in the water have caused repeated health crises in the Strip since the embargo began. In 2018, a report for NPR's Living on Earth, who visited the children's hospital in Gaza, found the causes of dehydration, diarrhea, which is the second leading killer of children worldwide, and kidney failure among children had tripled since the 2014 bombing of the Strip by Israeli forces. Stunted growth, marasmus, which is a kind of severe malnutrition, cases of pancreatic cancer had also multiplied exponentially. The reporter observed cases of blue baby syndrome, where babies' lips, face, and skin take on a bluish tint because of lack of blood oxygen. So consider the babies. Last Saturday, shocking and condemnable attacks drew comparisons from pundits to the attacks of September 11th. That is, last Saturday was to Israelis what the September 11th attacks were to Americans, a surprise attack that killed many civilians and instilled a disturbing sense of vulnerability. So all analogies are imperfect, and it's not helpful probably to pick at whether this might or might not perfectly hold as an analogy. They're often useful in spite of their limits, and so I'm going to dwell on this one in a second. First, I want to add something. Speaking of the limits and things that are not analogous, whenever we're talking about this, the situation of the Israeli-Palestine conflict, one of the things that's not analogous is the behavior of the Israeli army. And I'm shocked that over the past week that we've been hearing about the tradition in Israel of the purity of arms, right? So this is just sort of off the top of my head. I didn't plan to talk about this, but over 50 documented massacres in the 1948 war of civilian areas. The very famous Kfar Qasim slaughter of a Palestinian village in 1956, the Sabra and Shatila massacre. This is what got me thinking about this when Abed mentioned that while he was talking at the beginning. The Sabra and Shatila massacre, which was during the invasion of Beirut in 1982. In the 90s, then there was this like story that broke about POWs, which is like, I don't know, like I wasn't living in the United States at the time. I think it was very underreported here, but we know it's been documented by Israeli historians that in the 1956 and the 1967 conflict, large numbers of Egyptian, Syrian, and other Arab POWs that were captured in war by the Israeli forces during those conflicts were executed. And that never came out until, as I say, until courageous Israeli historians uncovered in the 90s. When Yitzhak Rabin was the minister of defense during the first Intifada, there was an open policy of breaking the bones of Palestinian children as a way of stopping them from throwing rocks. So this is a kind of history of the purity of arms of Israel, right? Now, back to my analogy of the September 11th attacks, like enough with the limitations of the analogy. After the shock of those attacks, sympathy for the United States and grieving for the loss of life that touched so many countries was almost universal. Notes of support came from unexpected rivals, even including Iran, which we hadn't negotiated our the nuclear treaty came much later during the Obama administration, right? So Iran, our sworn enemy, like cooperated, shared intelligence at the time as the conflict with Afghanistan began. President Bush talked about a new world with new strategies for the preservation of humanity at that first moment. And I remember asking a South Asian friend living in Brooklyn if she had seen any targeting of black or brown folks suspected of being Muslim on the street, and her telling me that that she had seen actually a lot more kind of commitments to protect immigrants and fight racism, even at the street level, right? However, we have other associations with September 11th because almost immediately, President Bush began employing not a new strategy for a new world, as he had suggested, but an old strategy of regime change. Abroad, the U.S. made up reasons to invade other countries, and at home it targeted Muslims and set up separate legal standards for them. The further these attacks faded into history, the September 11th attacks, the more Islamophobia has become institutionalized at home. The Muslim ban, right, that the Supreme Court validated very recently. Abroad, even our government's best friends in Europe, no longer completely trust us, and invasion and occupation have come to look like viable options for many powerful states with grievances against weaker neighbors. There was resistance to what the Bush government set out to do both at home and abroad, but it took time. Marches against the U.S. invasion of Afghanistan were tiny, and by the time citizens marched in large numbers against the invasion of Iraq, the plans for that invasion had already been fixed. Now, some have asked this week about the timing of folks coming out to show solidarity with Palestinians immediately following the killing of innocent Israelis. We remember the history of the September 11th attacks. No one was given time to properly mourn the dead or focus on the profound tragedy of that day. Immediately, we were thrown into a momentum for revenge against weak innocents. The Israeli siege of Gaza is transitioning from killing Palestinian children slowly to killing them quickly. Now is the time to stand against it.
That was Professor Hussam Abul-Ila, Arab American Educational Foundation, Ajuz Chair in Arab Studies at the University of Houston, speaking at the Emergency Palestine Teach-In held in October 2023 at the University of Houston, organized by the Arab American Educational Foundation Center for Arab Studies. 5 years ago, in November 2018, Dr. Mark Lamont Hill, an academic, author, activist, and television personality, was fired from his position as a commentator for CNN one day after he spoke at the United Nations at a special meeting of the Committee on the Exercise of the Inalienable Rights of the Palestinian People, in which he called for equal rights for all in historic Palestine. I'm going to share with you now the remarks he delivered at the United Nations that prompted CNN to fire him.
Mr. Secretary General, Chairman, Ambassadors, and Your Excellencies, good afternoon. It is with great honor and humility that I accept the opportunity to speak before you. As a scholar, as an activist, and as a citizen, I am profoundly interested in the plight of the Palestinian people, as well as the broader ethical, moral, and political implications of their struggle for freedom and justice, as well as equality. As such, this annual convening represents a critical intervention. It also represents a site of possibility. On the other hand, it shows considerable irony. As you well know, this year marks the 70th anniversary of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. This declaration is produced out of the rubble and contradictions of World War II, and it was intended to offer a clear ethical and moral outline of the basic rights and freedoms to which all human beings, irrespective of race, religion, class, gender, or geography, are entitled. This declaration, of course, has been far from perfect, both in design and in execution. Too often, we have framed human rights through the lens of the West. We've viewed it through the gaze of colonialism, and we have assessed them through the limited prism of our own experiences. Simply put, the powerful have too often attempted to universalize their own particular and local values. Still, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights has offered us a flawed but functional starting point from which to articulate basic moral and ethical ambitions as global citizens. These ambitions have been particularly helpful when attempting to keep track of the vulnerable against the backdrop of imperialism, exploitative economic arrangements, white supremacy, patriarchy, and all the other entanglements of the modern nation state. For this reason, it is indeed ironic and sad that this year also marks the 70th anniversary of the Nakba, the great catastrophe in May 1948 that resulted in the expulsion, murder, and to date, permanent dislocation of more than a million Palestinians. For every minute that the global community has articulated a clear and lucid framework for human rights, the Palestinian people have been deprived of the most fundamental of them. While the Universal Declaration for Human Rights says that all people are, quote, born free and equal in dignity and rights, the Israeli nation state continues to restrict freedom and undermine equality for Palestinian citizens of Israel, as well as those in the West Bank and Gaza. At the current moment, there are more than 60 Israeli laws that deny Palestinians access to full citizenship rights, simply because they're not Jewish. From housing to education to family reunification, it is clear that any freedoms naturally endowed to all human beings are actively being stripped away from Palestinians through Israeli statecraft. While human rights promises the right to life, liberty, and security of person, Palestinians continue to live under the threat of random violence by Israeli military and police, disproportionate violence within the West Bank and Gaza, unprompted violence in the face of peaceful protest, and misdirected violence by an Israeli state that systematically fails to distinguish between civilians and combatants. While the Universal Declaration for Human Rights protects us against torture and cruel and inhuman or degrading treatment or punishment, Palestinians continue to be physically and psychologically tortured by the Israeli criminal justice system, a term I can only use with irony. As human rights groups around the world have noted, the use of solitary confinement constitutes a clear and indisputable form of torture. Yet in the West Bank, Palestinians are routinely subjected to solitary confinement and indefinite detention, often without any formal charges being filed. Last year, the Israeli Supreme Court ruled that physical torture in, quote, exceptional cases, including ticking time bomb situations, constitute acceptable means by which to engage in torture. Although these exceptions are themselves a violation of the absolute human right not to be tortured, Israeli security operates in practice in such a way that nearly all Palestinian cases are viewed as exceptional. Nearly every Palestinian is understood to be a potential terrorist, thereby making them susceptible to ticking time bomb investigation tactics at all times. As such, Israel's practices are routinely in clear violation of the UN's Convention on Torture, which was signed by Israel in 1986 and ratified in 1991. While the Declaration of Human Rights insists that no one be subjected to arbitrary arrest, detention, or exile, Palestinians are routinely denied due process of law. West Bank Palestinians are regularly placed under administrative detention, a framework that allows them to be incarcerated for up to 6 months and can be extended after a judicial review without being charged with a crime. The only thing needed for such outcomes is the ambiguous claim of a security threat, a claim used by the Israeli state at all times, at all costs, and for all reasons. Through this vagueness, Palestinians are routinely punished for their political views rather than any actual threat of violence. The Declaration of Human Rights insists that all humans are entitled to a, quote, fair and public hearing by an impartial tribunal. Israeli military courts, the exclusive adjudicator, largely for West Bank residents, and in some cases Palestinian citizens of Israel, they have a conviction rate of more than 99%. That suggests that Palestinians are either more guilty than any other group in human history, or that the Israeli government is unwilling or incapable of offering fair and impartial trials for Palestinians. Declaration of Human Rights promises the right to freedom of movement and residence within the borders of each state, as well as the right to leave any country, including his, sick, own, and to return to said country. It is impossible to travel throughout historic Palestine and not see the blatant restriction of movement between cities in the occupied Palestinian territories, as well as inside the state of Israel. Standing checkpoints, temporary or flying checkpoints, annexation walls, and other security barriers prevent Palestinians from moving freely both within areas legally designated by the Israeli government and co-signed by the Palestinian Authority under the terms of Oslo, but also we see in Gaza the restriction of movement that is so severe that it literally defines life in the area. I promise you that I will not exhaust all of my time by enumerating every human rights violation perpetrated by the Israeli government. These are well known and have been well documented by every credible human rights organization in the world. Rather, I would like to speak to you about the urgency of the current moment. Forgive my thirst. I literally just got off of a flight from Palestine to come to address you this morning, and I was boycotting the Israeli water, so I was unable to quench my thirst. But thank you for your indulgence, or for indulging me, rather. As we speak, the conditions on the ground for Palestinian people are worsening. In recent decades, the Israeli government has moved further and further to the right, normalizing settler colonialism and its accompanying logics of denial, destruction, displacement, and death. Despite international condemnation, settlement expansion has continued. At the same time, home demolitions and state-enforced displacement continues to uproot Palestinian communities. For Gazans, the 11-year Israeli and Egyptian blockade by land, air, and sea has created the largest open-air prison in the world. With only 4% potable water, electricity access that is limited to 4 hours per day, 50% unemployment, and the looming threat of Israeli bombs, Gaza continues to constitute one of the most pressing humanitarian crises of the current moment. In the West Bank, conditions are not much better. Unemployment is generally around 18%, with frequent loss of income due to Israeli military closures, making it impossible for Palestinian workers to get access to jobs. Settlements and the extra land allocated for them, as well as closed military zones and other restrictions, make it impossible for Palestinian towns to grow. And in the midst of it all, Prime Minister Netanyahu's administration has become increasingly indifferent to critique, censure, or even scorn from the international community for its practices. Perhaps the most glaring example of this indifference, as well as the urgency of the current moment, is the recently passed nation-state law. Through this basic law, the Israeli state has officially rejected Arabic as an official state language. It has described settlement expansion, both inside and outside of the Green Line, as a national value, and it has reinforced the fact that Israel is not a state of all of its citizens. As an American, I am embarrassed that my tax dollars contribute to this reality. I am frustrated that no American president since the start of the occupation has taken a principled and actionable position in defense of Palestinian rights. And I am saddened, though not surprised, that President Trump's administration has further emboldened Israel's behavior through its recent actions. In May of this year, President Trump officially moved the U.S. Embassy to Jerusalem, which he recognized as the undivided capital of Israel. This choice not only flew in the face of international law and precedent, but also constituted a powerful provocation and a diplomatic death blow. In late August, President Trump then permanently reneged on America's commitment to funding UNRWA, a move that now leaves millions of Palestinian refugees in medical, economic, and educational peril. Moreover, the move serves as a political strong-arm tactic, whereby the United States is unilaterally attempting to resolve, through the Trump administration, the final status of Palestinian refugees. While President Trump's policies have been the most dramatic, it is important that I stress to you, to reiterate to you, that they are not wildly out of step with American policy. Cuts to UNRWA is an idea that has been raised in Washington for years, dating back at least to the George W. Bush administration. President Trump's decision to move the U.S. Embassy in Israel from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem caused enormous controversy, but he was merely implementing a bipartisan law Congress passed in 1995. And in so doing, he executed what has already been official United States policy and the fulfillment of a promise made by every United States president and presidential candidate, Democrat and Republican, for a very long time. With regard to the question of Palestine, Donald Trump is not an exception to American policy. Rather, Donald Trump is a more transparent and aggressive iteration of it. As I mentioned at the beginning of my remarks, the words offered today by everyone in this room are a necessary component of our resistance efforts. We need powerful, counterintuitive, dangerous, and courageous words. But we must also offer more than just words. Words will not stop the village of Khan al-Ahmar with its makeshift schools created by local Bedouin villagers. Words will not stop them from being demolished in violation of the Fourth Geneva Conventions. Words will not stop poets like Doreen Tetour from being caged in Israeli jails for having the audacity to speak the truth about the conditions of struggle on her own personal Facebook page. Words will not stop peaceful protesters in Gaza from being killed as they fight for freedom against Israel's still undeclared borders. Regarding the question of Palestine, beyond words, we must ask the question, what does justice require? To truly engage in acts of solidarity, we must make our words flesh. Our solidarity must be more than a noun. Our solidarity must become a verb. As a Black American, my understanding of action and solidarity action is rooted in our own tradition of struggle. As Black Americans resisted slavery, as well as Jim Crow laws that transformed us from a slave state to an apartheid state, we did so through multiple tactics and strategies. It is this array of tactics that I appeal to as I advocate for concrete action from all of us in this room. Solidarity from the international community demands that we embrace boycotts, divestment, and sanctions as a critical means by which to hold Israel accountable for its treatment of Palestinian people. This movement, which emerges out of the overwhelming majority of Palestinian civil society, offers a nonviolent means by which to demand a return to the pre-67 borders, full rights for Palestinian citizens, and the right of return as dictated by international law. Solidarity demands that we no longer allow politicians or political parties to remain silent on the question of Palestine. We can no longer, in particular, allow the political left to remain radical or even progressive on every issue, from the environment to war to the economy, to remain progressive on every issue except for Palestine. Contrary to Western mythology, Black resistance to American apartheid did not come purely through Gandhian nonviolence. Rather, slave revolts and self-defense and tactics otherwise divergent from Dr. King or Mahatma Gandhi were equally important to preserving safety and attaining freedom. We must allow, if we are to operate in true solidarity with Palestinian people, we must allow the Palestinian people the same range of opportunity and political possibility. If we are standing in solidarity with Palestinian people, we must recognize the right of an occupied people to defend itself. We must prioritize peace. We must not romanticize or fetishize it. We must advocate and promote nonviolence at every opportunity. But we cannot endorse a narrow politics of respectability that shames Palestinians for resisting, for refusing to do nothing in the face of state violence and ethnic cleansing. At the current moment, there is little reason for optimism. Optimism, of course, is the belief that good will inevitably prevail over evil, that justice will inevitably win out. In the course of human history, and certainly even in the course of the United Nations, there is no evidence of such a proposition. Optimism is unsophisticated. Optimism is immature. Optimism is what my students have when they take examinations that they did not study for. Some become quite religious at that time. But regardless of their strategies of optimism, the outcome is far from guaranteed or even likely. What I'm challenging us to do in the spirit of solidarity is not to embrace optimism, but to embrace radical hope. Radical hope is a belief that despite the odds, despite the considerable measures against justice and peace, despite the legacy of hatred and imperialism and white supremacy and patriarchy and homophobia, despite these systems of power that have normalized settler colonialism, despite these structures, we can still win, we can still prevail. One motivation for my hope in the liberation and ultimate self-determination of the Palestinian people comes in August of 2014. Black Americans were in Ferguson, Missouri, in the Midwest of the United States, protesting the death of a young man named Michael Brown, an unarmed African-American male who had been killed by a law enforcement agent. And as we protested, I saw two things that provided hope for the Palestinian struggle. One was that for the first time in my entire life of activism, I saw a sea of Palestinian people. I saw a sea of Palestinian flags in the crowd saying that we must form a solidarity project. We must struggle together in order to resist, because state violence in the United States and state violence in Brazil and state violence in Syria and state violence in Egypt and state violence in South Africa and state violence in Palestine are all of the same sort. And we finally understood that we must work together and not turn on each other, but instead turn to each other. And later that night, when the police began to tear gas us, Maryam Barghouti tweeted us from Ramallah. She, along with other Palestinian youth activists, told us that the tear gas that we were experiencing was only temporary. They gave us tips for how to wash our eyes out. They told us how to make gas masks out of t-shirts. They gave us permission to think and dream beyond our local conditions by giving us a transnational or a global solidarity project. And from those tweets and social media messages, we began then to organize together. We brought a delegation of Black activists to Palestine, and we saw the connections between the police in New York City who were being trained by Israeli soldiers and the type of policing we were experiencing in New York City. We began to see relationships of resistance, and we began to build and struggle and organize together. That spirit of solidarity, a solidarity that is bound up not just in ideology, but in action, is the way out. So as we stand here on the 70th anniversary of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and the tragic commemoration of the Nakba, we have an opportunity to not just offer solidarity in words, but to commit to political action, grassroots action, local action, and international action that will give us what justice requires. And that is a free Palestine from the river to the sea. Thank you for your time.
That was Dr. Mark Lamont Hill, an academic, author, activist, and television personality, speaking at the United Nations in 2018. One day after he spoke, after he delivered the remarks you just heard at the UN, CNN fired him as a commentator for that media outlet. You've been listening to Arab Voices, originating on KPFT Houston and syndicated on other radio stations in different cities in the US and Europe. Our shows are archived online, and you can listen to them by visiting arabvoices.net. And that does it for the show today. Thanks for listening. This is Saeed, executive producer and host of Arab Voices. Until we meet next week, peace on earth.